we are focusing on wellness as well as physical safety. And so we want to be real. And we know that substance abuse is an issue. And if somebody comes onto a construction site and they're not themselves or they're under the influence, everyone on that construction site is less safe.
You're listening to the Building Better Futures podcast, where innovation meets inspiration. In each episode, host Eric Hirani journeys alongside notable thought leaders who are shaping the future, cultivating exceptional work cultures, and nurturing the next generation of trailblazers. We aim to spark inspiration by engaging in dialogue with leaders from groundbreaking companies, innovative projects, and exceptional teams. Our goal is to empower individuals to positively impact those around them and leave a lasting legacy of positive change in our communities and society at large. Let's dive in together and explore what it takes to build better futures, one conversation at a time.
Hello. Today I'm joined by Elizabeth Crowley, President and CEO of the Building Trades Employers Association. Hey, Elizabeth, how are you?
I'm good, Eric. Thanks for having me on your Building Futures podcast.
Of course. This is a great time to have some conversation. And I know we were fortunate enough to see each other recently at the Build Safe conference you guys do. And we'll get to that in a moment. But I want to jump in. We always like to start every episode with good news and gratitude. Is there any like personal or professional good news or gratitude you have that you want to share with the audience?
Well, good news and gratitude. I'll start with our BTA safety conference. Last week was a resounding success. You know, the BTA has an annual safety conference every year. It was my third safety conference as president and CEO, and it was by far the best attended and most impactful safety conference that we've held so far. And Eric, I want to thank you for being a part of it. I think my gratitude is with certainly Mohammed Shalaheen on our BTA team who took lead on it. He is our development officer here. We also are so grateful to our hosts, Silverstein Properties. We had it at 7 World Trade Center, and Larry Silverstein himself sat down for a one-on-one interview about his new memoir, The Rising. So I'm grateful to him. And we wouldn't have this safety conference every year if it wasn't for the BTA's safety committee. Safety is a cornerstone for the BTA and our mission and in the work that we do. And we have two co-chairs of the safety committee. So big shout out to Bill Dayton of EJ Electric and Kevin Chase of Turner Construction for their leadership on this committee and the work they did in preparing for the conference and the whole safety committee of the BTA. We were just so thrilled with all that happened that day, and the continued work and success of the safety committee is a big part of why we're so grateful to have such a strong partnership with our contractor members.
Yeah, I got to tell you, and I've attended probably the last few safety conferences that BTA has put on there. They're amazing. You guys do a great job. And what a venue. That was an awesome location for it. So I know you mentioned the Silverstein Properties and Larry Silverstein, and just he was great to just hear him talk. And for someone that's so successful, what like a normal just guy, right? I mean, the interview was so just candid. It felt like really natural. And that was great to hear him talk.
Yeah, well, it's amazing to think that he acquired the lease of the World Trade Center in 2001, just before the attack, but he was 70 years old at that time.
Yep.
And today he's 94. And so he doesn't stop working. He's quite an inspiration. His book talks of many setbacks in just acquiring the space, and true New Yorker, grateful for the opportunity that he's had in life. He attributes that to New York growing up here and all that our communities here have to offer. And really, his story is one of resilience. And that is so true when you're there and reminded of all that the city went through on September 11th and how our industry was heavily involved with first building the Trade Center, Second, of course, there when we were at the pile for a recovery and certainly for rebuilding, which is the story of New York. No matter what happens with us here, no matter what setbacks our industry or our city faces, we never cease to amaze others and come back better and stronger. And our resiliency is so much a part of Lower Manhattan there. And so it was an exceptional day.
Yeah. New York City refuses to die. They try to call it every decade or so. There's something that comes by and they're like, oh, New York's not going to come back from this one. And
you think about it, like,
we are resilient.
The COVID crisis, right? We were ground zero for the COVID crisis as well, despite that setback. Superstorm Sandy, and just how much our city relies on the building and construction industry to get us through those crises.
It's a great point. We actually talked about that. We had Mike Wallace, the former like director of construction over at the Port Authority, on an episode. And we talked about that, especially like just after 9/11, how the building community, right, the industry came together to help. You know, people didn't have contracts. People were just showing up. People were like, hey, we're here to help. Let us know how we can support and help us get through that difficult time. So my gratitude on show day is always to the guests. So I really thank you for being on. I know you're extremely busy and it's always great to get to know you. So I always appreciate everyone taking some time out of their day to do this. So I'm going to jump into the first question, which is mostly just like, tell us about yourself. Give us the 90-second background on who is Elizabeth Crowley? Where did you grow up? Where'd you go to school? How did you get involved in something like this?
Well, I have a New York story, like so many others in the industry. I was born and raised in Queens. I still live in Queens. Born to a big family. I'm one of 15 children. And nobody in my family was in building or construction before I got involved. My parents were heavily involved in the community. They led by example. My mother was a school teacher. My father was a community lawyer. They both were involved in our community in a way where they both in their life were elected. My mother was on the local school board and my father first to the community parish council. And then I got involved with CUNY Higher Education, was on a board member, and then ran for office and was elected to the city council. Sadly, my dad passed away when I was young. I was only 7 and he didn't serve for a long time in a local government. But I was always inspired by the work that my parents did. And out of all my brothers and sisters, I'm the only one that actually ran for public office, but all of my siblings are in fields where they give back, whether they're teachers, nurses, lawyers, doctor, they're always looking to make a difference. And I think that work ethic and thinking of a larger community outside of ourselves or our own family, something that we learned by our parents and from one another and in the home that we were raised.
So how many siblings do you have? I heard almost 4 different. Do you have 4 siblings? Is that?
I have 14. 14.
14? Really?
Yes, 14. Yes, I'm number 14 of 15 children, all from the same mother and father. And yeah, I have one younger. So out of all the 15 of us, 15 together, there are 12 girls and 3 boys. And yeah, no, so it was a community in itself growing up in my house. It told me I had to fight for what was right, what I believed in. And sometimes it had to be my own fair share amongst the rest. But that gave me the experience, I think, that led me into this profession. Because then I knew when I was younger, I wanted to do something with my hands. You know, I was good with arts and crafts. And you would think, well, how does that relate to politics or the BTEA? But actually, I studied art restoration in college. I went to FIT in Manhattan, first fine arts, but they had an art restoration program. And it was in that program that I was able to take an internship on restoring interiors of buildings. In high school, I visited the Sistine Chapel. I was like, just after they had renovated the work of Michelangelo. And I wanted to be like that. And so before graduating from college, I went down to the Painters Union, very green and naive and not knowing a whole lot about the industry, with my portfolio. And I said, this is the type of work that I'm trained in and would love to do. And I know that your union represents painters like me. And they said, well, can you do gold leaf? And I said, yes. And I showed them some pictures of the work that I done as the artist doing restorative gold leaf work. And they said, well, we're looking for somebody just like you to work at Radio City Music Hall. And that project will start at the end of May. And I was like, amazing. I graduate in the end of May. I can start right away. And so with some safety training and a little bit of how to build scaffold and union initiation, I became a member of DC Line Painters Union and worked that summer on Radio City Music Hall, restoring a ceiling and wall of over 40,000 square feet on a massive renovation project, which probably was only about $100 million back then, but it was huge in 1999. And I stayed on to do the touches, and I stayed on touch-ups on that project, and I stayed on to, and I stayed involved in my union. And it really was the union involvement that propelled me into political office. I ran for, was elected to city council. And I continue to go for higher education degree, master's degree in architecture and city planning. I have a degree in planning from Pratt Institute. And I did all of that before I took office and was elected to city council in 2008. As the first woman and the first Democrat to represent my district in Queens.
Very cool. What's so much interesting information there. I love that story. I mean, one, even though we know each other, I didn't know that you came out of school and joined the union. I didn't know you were part of trade. That's incredible. And sure. I mean, I guess that makes this really mission-driven for you, what you're doing for here at the BTA.
Yes, when the opportunity presented itself and, you know, the mission of the BTA and just a little bit about the BTA. The BTA is the largest contractor association in the country. And we're proud to be union contractors. Our association represents over 1,200 different companies. So we're a business association, from construction management firms to specialty trade subcontractors, MWBE firms. And while we have the union construction industry, and my background in being a union painter, I was driven to this work because of my belief in the union, and not only being a part of, for me as a young adult out of school, the building and construction industry, but also knowing that I was being protected by a louder voice than mine. And that's exactly what the BTA is. It's a louder voice than one company, one contractor. It's a united voice. And we're there as the advocate of the union contractor, whether it's government affairs, public affairs, professional development. Certainly, we covered safety, innovation, and technology. And so we are there to do that. And that is the mission. And the mission was so aligned with the type of work that I've always gravitated towards, whether it was right at school or being in the council. And all of that experience helped prepare me to be here at the helm of the BTA today. And I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. Couldn't think of any other job that I'd be more fit to do. And I look at it as a privilege and an honor. I was serving as a public servant in the role of a political elected leader for my community. And I've been elected again, believe it or not, the way this association is represented between the many contractors. We have 100 members on our Board of Governors, and I was elected by the Board of Governors to be the president and CEO of the BTA.
Well, you're clearly passionate about it, and it's really exciting to hear you talk about it. You mentioned it's the largest in the country. Can you give us like broad overview? Like, what are some of the current challenges that are facing union construction workers today? You know, I know we hear a lot about it in the news, and then also, if you want to touch on any like recent lobbying efforts or ways that the community can help and support what you and the BTA are trying to do.
Sure. Well, that's a good question, Eric. So what sets us apart from other contractors is that we're a union. We're paying higher wages. We're having and prioritizing the safest construction sites in the city. And we play by the rules. We want to make sure that we're delivering for our clients, whether they're owners of buildings, members of the real estate community, REBME, some would say, or public owners, public entities, Port Authority, any government agency that has capital expenditure. while we're union contractors, the non-union contractors are out there and they're growing stronger and they're bidding on and getting awarded more work than ever before. And why is that an issue for the industry? Because they're not held to the same level of standards. We do not know what their employees are making, whether sometimes they're even getting paid legally on the books versus not. If you go to the Department of Buildings website, they recently tracked companies' safety records. And when you see which companies are union versus non-union, 80% of the injuries or fatalities are coming from non-union construction. Our construction is inherently more expensive, so we're a higher bidder. And that leads to less work and the market that is certainly considered private. So this is a big disadvantage for us, and we need to do all we can to bring down the cost of union construction and look at what drives our bids, if it's not our wages, if we put them aside, and materials that everyone pays the same amount for. We see that our insurance costs have gotten so expensive that have taken up such a large percentage of the total project cost that it's not practical any longer. We saw about 20 years ago, any given construction site of the city in New York would spend about 4% of its total cost on insurance. Today, that number is much closer to 12%, depending on the trade. Some, if you're a scaffold builder, it's much, much higher. We've recently, so one of our members had to drop their general liability insurance because of the cost. We're seeing how it's putting our businesses out. It's really an issue that I and UMass, the lobbying efforts, something that we're focused on right now. There's been an epidemic of staged accidents. You probably heard of the scaffold law, which gives 100% liability to the contractor despite mistakes that could have been made by a worker. A worker could come onto a construction site off hours, hang out with friends, get hurt. Our contractors are liable. So there's fault that should be evaluated that 49 other states have. And because of this complete liability, it opens it up for fraud and abuse. And so I was in Albany yesterday, actually spent the whole day meeting with state officials, the majority leader of the Senate, leaders of key committees, both in the Assembly and the Senate, that could help us get relief and help make this fairer and certainly hold bad actors accountable. And so that is what we're focused on amongst other efforts right now. And we're hopeful that the state legislature will make it a felony to stage a construction accident in the bills that they pass before the end of session, which is rapidly approaching.
This episode is brought to you by Infinite Consulting Corp, your go-to firm for MBE certified project and construction management consulting. Discover how Infinite can help you build a better future at infiniteconsultingcorp.com.
Those numbers are staggering, especially on the insurance side, right? If you think about what could we do with an additional between 5 and 10% of capital works, you know, with that money. I mean, obviously, insurance is very important. I'm not trying to downplay that, but I do think there's some regulatory challenges we have in the states, like in New York specifically, that the money isn't being best utilized, right? We should have insurance and we should protect our job sites and we shouldn't protect our workers and potential anybody that could be harmed by the work. But, you know, if we could get another 2, 3, 4, 5, 6% of that money back into the capital budget, it's significant. We're talking about billions of dollars, you know, of construction, hundreds of billions of dollars really annually. And that's a lot, you know, that's a lot. It does the needle.
When you look at the amount of money that has been put into the MTA's capital budget this year, it was a big win for the BTA because...
Big win for all of us.
Big win, $68 billion five-year capital plan the MTA has been allocated through the budget process. However, we still don't know whether we'll be able to keep congestion pricing in place. It's a lawsuit and there'll be hearings and a decision expected in the fall. We also don't know how much money that we're really entitled to, how much will come back from the federal government that we pay in taxes. That impacts our budget, and it trickles down to funds that we spend frivolously on insurance. We could have a better policy in place to stop that wasp from occurring. So that's what is unknown still too. Like, you spend, you allocate, you plan, and then you have all these additional costs that come.
I will say on the staged accidents also, that was terrible. And the investigation and what it revealed, I mean, it's at a certain point, it's also embarrassing that they were able to get away with this for so long. And everybody was complicit in it, it feels like. But I hope they do figure out a way to crack down on that, because that affects every single one of us. Because at the end of the day, the trade will get dragged in, but so does the owner, so does the engineer. So like, we do a lot of consulting work. And for what? For because someone knows they can get away with it, or because they know that the insurance company would rather settle than take it all the way through 3 or 5 years of litigation. Okay, fine, here's your payout. I mean, it's just not the right way to be.
And they don't even want to write insurance in New York anymore.
That's another big problem.
Yeah, little competition. And they'll go do business in another state where the laws are much more reasonable.
You know, I know we felt like it wasn't the most positive part of this, but I know we do a lot of positive and a lot of good here as an industry. And I know the BTA does that too. I was wondering, do you have any, like, either a personal story or a story from one of the organization members, like, emotionally, what does it feel like to fight for the worker protection that you do in an industry that's typically profit driven, right? I mean, at the end of the day, everyone's trying to make a bottom line number work and meet margin.
Profit driven and an industry of tough guys.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point too. Yeah. How do you do?
Well, I think when you said personal story, I'll just think of a personal story that I heard at our safety conference. Contractor came up to me and he actually shared a really sad story about what happened to him on a construction site when he was a foreman and there weren't a lot of people working. Somebody went missing, and sadly they found a construction worker that took his own life that day. And I didn't realize this before I took on the helm of the PTA, that construction suicide is a very high rate in comparison to any other industry here. And so that story hit home. It is very sad to hear that. And we want to do whatever we can do in this tough guy industry to let everybody know it's okay to not be okay, that you have a friend in your foreman or in each other, and certainly in the company that employs you. And we are focusing on wellness as well as physical safety. And so we want to be real. And we know that substance abuse is an issue. And if somebody comes onto a construction site and they're not themselves or they're under the influence, everyone on that construction site is less safe. And we need to be wise about the industry, because there's a mental health epidemic happening in our country. We've noticed this post the pandemic. And so know that the BTA has a program. And since we started to bring more attention to this issue and more awareness, more and more contractors have joined on, and the building and construction trade industry is also committed to making a difference and affecting the industry in a positive way by creating programs and offering services for free for members to come for help.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that you guys are working on that. At the conference, Eve Biggers led a panel on, from Curtis Project, she led a panel on that very topic. And it was just kind of eye-opening and also sad in a lot of ways to hear the stories, but really uplifting to see what they're trying to do and how they're trying to provide the resources, right? The help that everyone needs to, so they have someone to call if they're feeling a certain way or thinking a certain way. Because a lot of the safety we focus on is, hey, everyone's got to go home the same way they came here. And we kind of focus on that as like a physical thing, right? 10 fingers, 10 toes kind of situation. But there's a mental aspect to everything we do in life. And it does feel like it gets overlooked and not talked about. No, look,
we're all human. We have our good days and we have our bad days. And work is stressful. Some days you don't feel stressed at all, but work presents challenges and challenge can be stressful. And knowing that this too shall pass and the stress will go away and the burden will feel less if you have somebody else that you could share with who could lend advice, or it may come to a point where you actually need to speak to a professional in that field. But to think and know that we should have the tools, just how we have the tools to stay safe on a job site, tools to keep everybody safe if they're going through a mental health crisis.
You touched on the stresses of work. And obviously in this role, I'm sure you face your fair share of challenges in negotiating with like the developers and the owners and whoever else you have to negotiate with at certain times. What is your biggest challenge in that, like in that aspect of your job, Ben?
Wow, that's a good question. I think it's making sure that we're communicating with all of our contractors. It's a challenge to let our members know externally that we're here to help. And so it's a continuous effort. We do a monthly insider newsletter where we blast it out to our whole community. We try to make sure we have everybody's up-to-date email list, but it never fails. We had that safety conference last week and people said, "What? Well, I didn't know about it. How did you?" So it's always an effort to keep our membership engaged because there's times we could help them and they don't think to ask the BTA, but we want to be helpful. If it's a government issue or an issue that a business owner faces as a business owner, what if you want to change the dynamics of your business? What if you want your business to become an employee-owned business? What if you're hiring and expanding and it's not through the trades, but you need to hire internally and grow your project management staff, or you just need an administrative assistant? Where can you go to help? So we want to be there for the small business or our businesses to call when they need help. We want to be able to deliver the value that they deserve as a member of the BTA.
That is really cool. And I see that being a challenge because I personally didn't know all of the other facets there, right? That the way you guys kind of support the organizations in terms of just like managing the business or maybe hiring and not necessarily just the trade hiring, right? There's the whole corporate side of hiring. You need to build and expand your team.
And we want to build and expand to do that better too. So the BTA, while we're serving our membership, we want to do better in serving them. So we're always continuing to assess the services that we offer. And we want to be able to help incubate that small MWBE firm to grow, to bid on bigger projects, to be able to expand the services and maybe go into another trade and be able to do more than just one, like a painter or a paper hanger or a company that would like to then install glass, you know. So there are many ways that we could help through our partnership with the unions and the training programs that are offered through a joint labor management or technology and making sure that they have the tools that could be a company that serves, such as your company, the contractors, and you have a service to offer. We want to make sure that we're also extending the opportunity to our associate members of the BTA who are not the full-fledged members through the employing of the union tradespeople, but those that are bringing services to our membership, we want to make sure that we're there to help them do what they're doing even better and make the connections to our members so that they could help one another. And so that's why the BTA is always looking to do better and to grow and renew its partnership with its members.
That's really exciting. And it sounds like you're a resource and a partner above all else. Like, let's help everybody in our ecosystem be better. And I like that as like a value by which that you can live by. I want to talk a little bit about the next generation, because that's a big part of the show. And I always like to focus on, like, as an industry, we are having trouble attracting new people. And I think that extends to the trades as well. Or not, I know it extends to the trades as well. Do you have any like thoughts or advice? Like, how can we encourage younger people to learn about the trades, to join the trades? And then what support is available to them? Like maybe from the BTA? Earlier you mentioned training. You know, I think that's probably something you guys are actively promoting.
In my role as a leader of the BTA, I also am a part of a nonprofit organization. I serve on the board of three in particular that help New Yorkers become members of the building and construction trade industry. So they're called pre-apprentice programs. I sit on the board of Non-Traditional Employment for Women that is focused on women, could be first career or new career in the industry. They do a good job out there promoting the trades, and we want to be helpful. And I, as a board member, to retaining the women to make sure they graduate through an apprentice program and become an active member of their trade, potentially working back office. In addition to that, not just on employment of women, we also have Helmets to Hard Hats, very similar program, veterans. And lastly, for our high school seniors, who are high school seniors in New York City Public Schools. It's a partnership that was started with the School Construction Authority to make sure that we're giving opportunity city public school residents, city residents who are public school students, an opportunity to join the trades. While we're doing that, we need to do more. And the BTA is committed to doing more, to catching those community college students that do not think of themselves as going into the engineering field, to know about construction management. And whether it's just community college students in Manhattan College or other existing engineering programs, that there's work here in the trades. If you get a degree in engineering, we could help you build and reinvest in New York City.
Well, you're like the perfect story for that, right? I mean, you went to school, obviously you got a degree, and then you went to the union and you were like, hey, look at this talent I have, I can do this.
No, it is my story. And the union and the industry has offered me a lot of opportunity, and there's so much opportunity out there. As we, as a city, we are always challenged. We're the most dense city in the country. We're always growing vertically and horizontally. We need to invest in our building and infrastructure, and we need the best talent to be attracted to help us in. And that's why I am grateful to you, Eric, and your Building Better Futures podcast to help get that message out there to young people that we need you. And this is a very exciting, rewarding industry where there'll be lots to learn and lots to give back.
I agree. And that is a big focal point here, right? We want to inspire the next generation of leaders, the next generation entering this industry. I was very fortunate. I've had a lot of great mentors and a lot of good people, you know, around me in my life, and my family's been part of this industry for a long time, and it means a lot. Thank you for acknowledging and appreciating that. Do you have some advice for the next generation of leaders? What's some advice you like kind of live by?
Always do your best.
I like that. And do you have a quote or like mantra? I don't know. Like, I'm a quotes person, and then I can never remember the quotes, but
I like quotes too. I mean, I think of RFK, right? Robert F. Kennedy. He said, some see things the way they are and say why. I see things that have never been and say why not. So think big, always challenge the status quo, and you'll have a good career no matter where you land, as long as you continue to do your best, think outside of the box, and work to make a difference.
That is such an amazing quote. I have a list of quotes in my phone that I keep, and it's like hundreds at this point.
Give me your favorite. I'd love to hear it. Which one?
I'm going to add that to it.
Which one do you want to share today?
So my favorite right now, and I've slightly altered it, but it's by Dan Martell, and who's like an entrepreneur and like business, like coach kind of person. But he talks about how like, if you're not living, you're dying basically, right? Like you have to live your life to the fullest. And so the original quote is, if you're not living, you're dying. My plan is to live so hard that death can't keep up. And like, I really love that. Slightly modified it to change living to growing, because I don't know, it just applies more to everything I'm trying to do, like both personally and professionally. But same idea. It's just like, I just want to grow so fast that death can't keep up with what we're trying to do. So, but I love that quote.
Work hard, play hard, run hard.
Lots of good quotes. I mean, there's another one I live by. I have two, like, I don't know, life rules, I guess. And they're very simple. And one is celebrate everything. And I try to do that with my family. We try to celebrate all the big or small things. We try to do that as a company. We always start every meeting the same way I start the podcast, with good news and gratitude. But the second one is from Boy Meets World. This is a show I watched growing up and I really like. And I think it's like one of the last scenes, if not the, but they're just asking their teacher, like, what should we do in life now? Because they've had the same teacher for basically their whole life. It's a TV show, so it doesn't have to be realistic. And he just says two simple words, and he says, be good. And I really like that. Like, be good, do good in everything you do. And so those are my favorite quotes, a couple of them.
Be good and do good.
Yeah, I think all that's
words
really
to live
important
by.
And simple. Yeah. All right, cool. Well, Elizabeth, I really appreciated your time here. We are going to wrap up with the lightning round. So I'm going to go through three quick questions and you can answer them however you fit. And if they don't apply, just let me know. But the first one is, do you like to work out? And if you do, what's your favorite type of workout?
I like to work out. I like to go for a run. And my favorite type of run is on the beach.
Oh, cool.
I live in Rockaway, and so I'm blessed to be close to the water. And that's where I like to work out.
Very nice. What never fails to make you laugh?
Well, what never fails to make me laugh? A good joke, I guess. I have a 7-year-old nephew, and he is so cute. He always tells jokes, and they're simple jokes, like old grandpa-type jokes. But the way he says these jokes, he has me, like, laughing on the floor.
That's awesome. And then the last one is favorite, like, mode of transportation. Do you like to drive places? Do you like to fly places? Do you like to be on a boat? How do you like to get around?
Well, if I'm not walking, right, using my feet to run or walk, I like to be on trains.
Cool.
Actually, I really like the air train. And believe it or not, it's something that we have by JFK Airport.
Yep.
And I actually take it a lot of time to commute home. Not meant to do that, right? But you do have to pay two ways when you're taking the Long Island Railroad to Jamaica AirTrain. But you get to go through parts of the airport. I get to see the construction happening at the terminals. And then as it winds its way down to Howard Beach, where I get off and heading home, especially late at night, the way the sun glistens on the water that surrounds the airport is really beautiful in an idyllic way that nobody would ever think of JFK that way. But here we are in New York. So when we're taking the subway a lot of times or different trains, we're not completely outside. That air train is. And it's a shame. So many New Yorkers don't take the air train to get to the airport. I know it's meant for the one seat or the closest thing we have to a one seat ride to the center of the city. But so many New Yorkers just jump in a cab to get to the airport. They shouldn't. This is often the quickest way to get to the airport as well. And whether you're coming from Brooklyn, Atlantic Terminal to the LIRR, or Grand Central, or Penn Station, there's my plug for making sure you take the train to the airport.
I love that. And I would agree. I think trains, and specifically like the New York City subway, I rarely drive into the city, if ever. Like I like jumping on the Long Island Railroad. I get to work or sleep or read whatever I want to do. I get to the city. I jump on a subway. I get to wherever I need to be. Don't have to worry about like gridlock or traffic or stuff. So plug for public transportation. I love it.
Yeah.
Right there with you.
Absolutely. It's good for the economy. It makes New York affordable to live, do business. And it's good for the environment too. So it makes complete sense.
It's a lot of win-win situations.
It gives our members work to do.
Maintain that too.
And growing our transportation infrastructure.
For sure. Very cool. Well, Elizabeth, it's been amazing having you on. I want to take a minute here if you have any final thoughts or anything else you want to share.
No, thank you for your time today and the work that you do, Building Better Futures. I am going to be an avid listener of your podcast now that you invited me on. I love to listen to podcasts when I'm on the train.
Well, I hope you do. And I'd appreciate any comments or thoughts you have. And I will just applaud you for like how talented you are, because I know you have to go and testify soon. And I can't.
I got to go and testify right now at the Planning Commission. I'm getting cold, actually, right now.
Go ahead. Sorry. Go do your thing.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
This episode is brought to you by Infinite Consulting Corp., your go-to firm for MBE certified project and construction management consulting. Discover how Infinite can help you build a better future at infiniteconsultingcorp.com.